we were. Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Monday, May 11th, and I would like to open a public hearing on 2560, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I bring Dr. Coronado with me?
Yes, please. You're the only two signed up for the bill.
Oh, dynamic duo. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenock, House District 33, one of the House members that goes with Senator Steiner Hayward. Particularly pleased to be here for here, and I'm delighted to be testifying on House Bill 2560. In the last session, I think the 2013 session, we started an effort to improve colorectal cancer screening. I've been stimulated in this by the work of Dr. Coronado, who will be talking to you shortly, stimulated me to try and turn research findings into law. In the last session, we passed a bill that allowed colonoscopies, even when they found a polyp as a part of a preventive service, to be treated as a preventive service, so that therefore the subscriber didn't have to pay copay. So by doing that, we hoped we had stimulated colonoscopies. The bill before you today is a bill to reduce the use of colonoscopies by stimulating the use of other testing methods, fecal testing methods of a couple of kinds, that would only lead to a colonoscopy when the primary screening test found some suspicion. But the problem with the current way of doing that is if you take an FIT test, for example, it shows positive, you go to a colonoscopy, that's no longer a preventive service, that's a therapeutic service or a diagnostic service because it's diagnostic out of the primary screening test. This bill would allow a colonoscopy that comes as a result of a prior test to be treated still as a preventive service to avoid the copays on the part of the patients. I've been asked whether this would create an insurance mandate, and to some extent it does create an insurance mandate, but it creates an insurance mandate that should reduce the cost of health care rather than increase it. We shouldn't have to pay a penalty for a mandate, and I think the insurance companies will agree we haven't had any opposition to this bill from the insurance companies, because it actually ends up improving the colorectal cancer screening and costing less money. So I'm here to urge you to move this bill forward and to share with you my colleague sitting here, who I will proudly point out is the Mitch Greenlick Endowed Investigator at the Center for Health Research.
I'm more a protege than a colleague, right? it's an honor to be here today, and thank you for that introduction. And
state your name.
My please. Name is Dr. Gloria Coronado from Kaiser Permanente's Center for Health Research. And I'd like to give a little bit of information to the committee about a research grant that's NIH-funded called the Stop CRC Project.
It confused me getting email about Stop CRC from multiple sources, but this is the good Stop CRC.
And I'm actually on the advisory committee, even though you never see me there.
Fascinating. What is? If it's true that all living things eat and all living things poop, then how come no one wants to talk about it?
Probably the same reason no one wants to talk about colon cancer screening either, even though it saves lives.
Well, I guess I can understand that. I am not looking forward to my first colonoscopy.
Me either. It's really invasive. You have to drink a gallon of laxative, take time off work, and find someone to drive you to the clinic. But did you know there's an alternative? It's called the FIT test.
Ugh, I hate tests.
This one's easy. It's a simple test you do at home. You lay down a piece of paper on the toilet, poop on it?
Ew!
Collect just a little bit of the poop with a special stick, put it in a little container, and mail the whole thing to a lab. There, they'll look for tiny amounts of blood in the soil that would indicate a problem.
You can send poop in the mail?
Yep. And here's the thing. If people understand they can do a FIT test instead of colonoscopy, more people will get screened.
How do you know?
Well, this lady did a study about it. She mailed FIT tests to hundreds of people in Portland, Oregon, who haven't been screened for colon cancer, and 40% mailed them back.
That's an impressive response rate.
It sure is. And these are people who get their care from community clinics. Many of them are minorities or uninsured. Their rates are typically pretty low.
Well, I'm definitely going to take the FIT test in, 43 years.
Me too.
Did you know snakes poop?
Darling. Horrible.
That last was a true statement, by the way.
Everybody poops.
Hey, everyone. It's Chris from ChrisBeatCancer.com. And today I've got a really cool interview. I'm excited to share this with you. This is my friend Valerie Warwick. And
okay, let's get out of that. Troy, do you want to come up too then? Because you're the last one.
Just make it a party.
Thanks, everyone.
I'm going to go to judiciary.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative.
You'd be nice to these people.
Okay.
We're always nice to people.
You're asking a lot, man.
Thanks, Representative. So I think I get about 10 minutes to present. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm going to give some information about our strategy for improving colorectal cancer screening in community clinics, a project called Stop CRC, which is an NIH-funded study through the NIH Common Fund. This slide shows why we're interested in colorectal cancer. We know that colorectal cancer is a leading cause of cancer death in this country, and yet about a third of age-eligible adults in the U.S. are not up to date with screening recommendations. Yet colorectal cancer is highly preventable. For patients who were diagnosed with stage 1 disease, the chances of surviving 5 years is 93%. For patients who are diagnosed with stage 4 disease, the chances of surviving 5 years is only 8%. Screening is effective, it's inexpensive if you consider fecal testing, and it's easy to do. Patients who are unscreened generally receive care at community clinics. And if you look at the information on the right, you see that there's an important health disparity with regard to screening. That is that patients who are Hispanic, that have lived in this country for fewer than 10 years, or who are uninsured have a dramatically lower screening rate than the general population in the U.S. What we see in the state of Oregon is that over half of the cases of colon cancer are diagnosed at either the regional or advanced stage, meaning that the survival chances are pretty low. What we also see from state behavioral risk factor surveillance data is that there's an important health disparity, with the overall screening rate from self-reported data being about 57%, but the screening rate for Latinos being only 21%. Yeah. And so there's a clear health disparity with regard to screening in the state that we'd like to address. The recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force call for screening every year using high-sensitivity fecal occult blood testing, which includes a fecal immunochemical test, or colonoscopy every 10 years, or the combination of sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, plus an integral fecal test. We know that changes that were made to the Affordable Care Act allow screening to be paid for without no out-of-pocket cost. Senator Sheet.
Sigmoidoscopy, what's that?
Sigmoidoscopy is a scope of the colon that only goes partially of the colon.
Right, so it's a partial.
It's a partial colonoscopy, yep. Yet FIT testing is a viable and important option. So with the new FIT test, there are no dietary or medication restrictions. It used to be with an FOBT test that 3 samples were required. We know that with a new FIT test, a single sample can be required, but it requires colonoscopy follow-up. Several studies recently have shown that patients prefer fecal testing over colonoscopy in studies that have collected data in any given year. And in some geographic regions, and I would argue in some geographic regions in the state of Oregon, there's limited colonoscopy capacity.
And fecal testing can allow you to identify patients who have the highest risk of having colon cancer and putting your efforts into referring those patients to a colonoscopy. There are a variety of patients who are reluctant to get screened and won't get screened unless they believe that something's wrong. And fecal testing can be a useful strategy for identifying something that is wrong that then motivates a patient to get screened. And you see this in data showing that when patients are referred directly to a screening colonoscopy, only about 40% of them follow through. Yet if patients are referred to colonoscopy after having an abnormal FIT test, between 60 and 90% of those will complete the test. Fecal testing can reduce mortality by 33%. And in modeling studies, it's shown that fecal testing and colonoscopy are equally effective at reducing colon cancer mortality. And so it's a very important viable option. And one of the interesting things getting at the colonoscopy capacity is that the number that are needed to scope to find an advanced adenoma in the colonoscopy screening scenario is about 47, meaning that you have to do 47 colonoscopies in order to find an advanced adenoma that either could or cannot be cancerous. So this is a finding a polyp, right? However, if you begin with the FIT-based scenario where you offer FIT testing first, you have to do colonoscopies only on 8 patients in order to find an advanced adenoma. And so this is really the benefit of offering FIT testing is that you can identify those high-risk patients.
Understanding here.
Can I translate that back into English just to make sure and I'm a doctor, I should be able to get this, but ultimately what we're saying is colonoscopy is a really good test, but it's mm-hmm. expensive and people don't like to do it, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
That's kind of the bottom line. And
yep.
so people don't do it.
Yep.
And even though we know it's a really good test, we still have to do a lot of them to save one life, essentially, right?
Yeah.
But if we do this less expensive, more acceptable test first and use that as a double screening test, which is to say it's a screening test for any blood, and then it's a screening test for whether you really need a colonoscopy, then you only end up needing to do 8 colonoscopies to find one person, to potentially save one person's life,
yep.
and it's going to cost you a lot less money, and more people are going to get screened.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Yep.
Just want to make sure I was translating it into English in the right way.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank
right.
you very much. These are data that were published in 2013 from a study that was done in a safety net health system in Texas that included about 5,000 patients that were randomized to either receive usual care, to receive a free colonoscopy, or a free FIT test. And what it shows is that the highest screening rates were achieved among patients who were offered a free FIT test, meaning that even when you eliminate the financial barriers to screening, you still have higher patient adherence when patients are given the opportunity to do FIT testing. In addition, in interviews that we've conducted with medical directors and nurses from safety net clinics in Oregon, we've heard over and over that the limited access to colonoscopy really impedes the use of FIT. And so some of the providers will say that it's difficult for us to do fecal testing because we can't be guaranteed that our patients can get a colonoscopy. And a couple of quotes are, I hear a lot of frustration from doctors that want to have their patients have a colonoscopy, and it's just not happening. It's really an expensive exam. And so what we believe is that in order to really make fecal testing continue to be a viable option, that we need to make sure that there aren't barriers to accessing colonoscopy as a second part of the screening test. So STOP-CRC is a two-phase pragmatic study funded by the National Institutes of Health. In the first phase, we identified eligible patients in our participating clinic, which was Virginia Garcia. And we set up a system to track colorectal-related outcomes. And we tested two different approaches for raising the rates of colorectal cancer screening. One of them was an automated approach involving the mailing of a FIT test to patients' homes. And the other was an automated strategy involving the mailing of the FIT test as well as follow-up phone call reminders. And then as our last steps in phase one were to recruit 26 clinics in Oregon and California where we could test this program more broadly. So in the first year, we worked in partnership with Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center, which many of you are familiar with, which is a health center that operates four clinics in Washington and Yamhill counties in Oregon. And we specifically worked with two clinics that are circled in the graph on the lower left. And what you can see in these two clinics is that even for patients that were age 50 to 74, the age for which colorectal cancer screening is recommended, that there's a high proportion of Latino patients in those clinics. And what you also see is that the fecal testing rate was quite low. It was only about 4% in those clinics. And so we tested our two approaches. The automated intervention, again, was the mailing of an introductory letter, a fit kit, and a reminder postcard. And what we found is that about 40% of their patients returned their fit kit. In the clinic where we did the automated mailing as well as a reminder phone call, we got a similar result, meaning that about 40% of patients in each of the clinics returned their fit kit. In those clinics, we found that 7 of the patients had a positive test result, and 2 of those 7 did not have healthcare insurance, and they were referred to Project Access Now that provided that specialty care for free for those patients. What you see on the right is a graphical image showing the difference in our screening rate in those two clinics and the subset of patients in those two clinics compared to the rate in a usual care clinic. And again, the fecal testing rate overall was relatively low. In the phase 2, where we are working with 26 clinics, this map shows the location of our 26 sites. Many of them are in the Portland metropolitan area, but we also have sites in Bend as well as Medford and then down into the northern part of California. We are also working with some clinics in Washington State to roll out the program in a different EMR platform. What's encouraging to us so far is that we see from data from Virginia Garcia is that we actually had a slightly higher response rate among Spanish speakers than English speakers. And this actually is encouraging given what we see as a key health disparity with regard to colorectal cancer screening in our state.
Are you up? Just a conclusion. Yeah. All right.
So in conclusion, we know that colorectal cancer screening saves lives and that fecal testing can lower colon cancer mortality. We know that screening rates are low, and they're particularly low in diverse racial and ethnic minority groups and persons of low socioeconomic advantage. And what we've shown is that a direct mailed approach can boost screening rates in hard-to-reach populations.
Thank you very much. Troy.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Vice President Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Troy Rayburn. I'm the Director of State Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, which is the advocacy arm of the American Cancer Society. We've submitted testimony in advance. We know that you folks read your correspondence, so I'm not going to go into great detail and repeat it verbatim. I just wanted to go on the record and support Dr. Coronado and Representative Greenlick and all the fantastic work that they're doing.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And also thank you for having a terrific event on Saturday night, the American Cancer Society fundraiser. It was really a wonderful event.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Technical question. Being very health conscious as I am, I'm supposed to get a colonoscopy at age 50, right? Mm-hmm. So I did it at age 59.
That's pretty good compliance, actually, Senator.
Which ain't bad for me. So I had, I think, 5 polyps removed, none of them cancerous, okay? Mm-hmm. I would, at this point, they told me I needed to go back in 5 years. Would a fit test be a substitute for that in my case?
So the stock answer is that you should do what your doctor tells you to do.
I know that, but
I think that I would have to look at the recommendation for surveillance after polyps are removed. It sounds like if your polyps are negative, that they're recommending a colonoscopy, and I would do that. I think that if you have a completely negative colonoscopy, the recommendation is either that you get a colonoscopy 10 years. Or you can get fit testing in 10 years as well. So you can have the option of going back to fit testing in some cases, although in your case, I would do what your doctor recommends.
Damn.
All right. Thank you very much. I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2560 and open a work session on House Bill 2560.
I'm trying to move House Bill 2560 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2560 to the floor, House Bill 2560A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz, will you carry the bill? And I will close the work session on House Bill 2560.
It's your turn to carry a colonoscopy bill.
Yes. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2934.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2934A directs the Oregon Health Authority to convene a stakeholder work group to provide recommendations on operation of a basic health program. It specifies work group membership, when the first meeting shall occur, and to develop recommendations to be reported to the interim health care committees no later than December 1st, 2015. There's no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, John Mullen, Janet, is it Bauer, and Alberto Marrero?
Marino.
Oh, Marino. It's an N. Sorry.
They
all and you can call Christina Narayan?
Close.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Here today to speak in support of House Bill 2934A as a simple but important bill. A couple of little bits of background on this. I first testified in the legislature about the basic health plan back in 2012. What we discovered from talking to each other that a lot of us had a like-minded approach to looking at this option under the Affordable Care Act. And so with me today, you're going to hear testimony from Janet Bauer from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Alberto Moreno from the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, and Christina Narayan from the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. You'll see from the information on OLIS that we have quite a group of organizations and networks that support moving forward with discussion on basic health. We formed a coalition, the Inclusion Affordability Innovation Coalition, and our values are really very much in our name. And you'll hear a little bit about that discussion about affordability and inclusion, and also our challenge to Oregon to be innovative about our next wave of the work that we need to do on affordable care and inclusive care for the state of Oregon. One thing that I want to, though, do is return to the bill itself, which simply requires the Oregon Health Authority to gather a stakeholder group together to continue discussion on basic health. I want to be sure that the committee understands that this does no way obligates the state to move forward on basic health, but continues this very important discussion. So again, I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Janet, who will talk a bit about basic health, what it's about, and Alberto and Christina will follow up, and then I'll come back and do a very quick wrap. We'll be relatively quick. Again, this is a simple but important bill, and we hope to have your support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer, and I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. The center is a part of the Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition that supports consideration of basic health in Oregon. I'm here today to talk briefly about the study that you commissioned in the last session and why House Bill 2934 is the right next step for us to take. As you know, Oregon has made great progress in health reform. However, our work is not done. By one report, 120,000 Oregonians who are required to have insurance are uninsured. The majority of these individuals make too much to qualify for Medicaid and find that the cost of plans in Oregon's marketplace to be unaffordable despite generous federal subsidies. Fortunately, basic health offers Oregon a way forward. It offers the potential to address this problem in a way that it would have little impact on Oregon's budget. So briefly, how would a basic health program work? Basic health is an option under the Affordable Care Act for states to cover low-income working age residents. Instead of shopping in the exchange, these individuals would receive coverage from the state at more affordable rates. The state would receive funding from the federal government to operate the program. The feds, by the way, would do this by redirecting to the state the dollars that it would otherwise spend in the marketplace subsidizing their coverage. In the last session, in the last legislature, thanks to you, you commissioned a study to find out whether basic health would be a good fit for Oregon and would be feasible. And the study brought good news. It found that, depending on the program design, as many as 66,000 Oregonians would be expected to enroll. The impact of that would be the share of low-income folks eligible for marketplace coverage but who would go uninsured would drop from 17% to as low as 6%. If they were to be offered the Oregon Health Plan benefit package, they would gain services not typically offered, covered under marketplace plans, such as adult dental coverage. Further, low-income families would likely see their out-of-pocket costs drop. About 56,000 Oregonians living paycheck to paycheck would save on average as much as $1,600 a year. For a low-income family, that savings is substantial. Basic health could bring other benefits, such as reducing churn, which is a word for the administrative costs that happen when people frequently switch between plans when their income fluctuates. Also, the good news, the marketplace would be expected to remain stable despite losing some customers. The study found Oregon could operate a program at little or no cost to Oregon's budget. The federal funds would cover the bulk of the program. In addition, basic health would create several cost-saving opportunities for Oregon's budget, and by taking advantage of those, Oregon's program could fully pencil out or create a modest surplus. And I describe the details of what the study says about program financing in a separate memo to you that is on OLIS. The central takeaway from the study is that the potential for basic health really depends on designing it well. So the next step for Oregon is to roll up its sleeves and figure out the details. And this brings us to House Bill 2934. It asks the Oregon Health Authority to lead a consensus process among stakeholders to recommend key program design details that would make the program most successful. To conclude, basic health does offer a way forward. It's a potential win-win for Oregon families and the state. Since program design is so key to program success in addressing current gaps in coverage in Oregon, I urge you to take the next step and approve House Bill 2934. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much.
Esteemed Chair, Vice Chair, committee members, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I also have the distinct privilege of serving as Chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, on which one of my esteemed senators sits. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2934. The bill is the next logical step in ensuring affordable access to health care for all Oregonians. We believe that a basic health plan option is good for Oregon and Oregon's workforce. Specifically, basic health plan could help extend health insurance coverage for legally present immigrants. Let me say that again, for legally present immigrants who would otherwise qualify for Medicaid, except for the fact that they are here within the first 5 years of U.S. residency. The immigrant community plays an important role in our economy, and their health affects us all. farm workers, for example, contribute over $5.3 billion to Oregon's economy each and every year. And this Latino community in Oregon wields over $8 billion, worth repeating, $8 billion in buying power in our state alone. Unfortunately, many of these legal immigrants do not qualify for Medicaid, even if they are Medicaid income eligible. By federal law, legal immigrants with Medicaid-level incomes must wait 5 years before they can enroll. This is referred to as a five-year bar. If you earn poverty wages, as in the case of farm workers, for example, whose annual salary is less than $10,000 a year, you already struggle to put food on your children's table, clothe them, and pay utilities. Paying costly monthly premiums and copays when you visit the doctor represents a considerable hardship for these families and drives health-seeking behaviors, which result in deferral of care and subsequent ER visits. A basic health plan option in Oregon can help this vital workforce get insurance, keep their coverage, and see a doctor when they need to stay healthy. In conclusion, we respectfully ask that you support this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christina Narayan. I am a policy associate with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. You may know us as APANO. Asian and Pacific Islanders are the fastest growing population in the United States. It is a trend that is mirrored here in Oregon. And our organization has been deeply engaged with this population, advocating on behalf of the over 220,000 APIs who call Oregon home. Well, I am included. While we see pockets of prosperity, many within our community continue to face systematic barriers to opportunity. Many experience uninsurance and the crippling financial effects of acquiring culturally competent healthcare as consequence. We applaud the positive steps taken to improve and make Oregon's healthcare system more accessible, namely through the transition to CCOs. However, even with these positive efforts, many of Oregon's most vulnerable populations continue to fall through the cracks. With your help, we can begin to address these gaps. Asian and Pacific Islanders have come to the United States for a slurry of reasons, but many share a similar story. We are here because you were there. Oregon's largest waves of Asian and Pacific Islanders have come to the United States as a direct result of military and economic interventions upon our native homes. Like many, our Asian Pacific Islander communities are deeply connected to our families. As our families work to reunite with their loved ones, with their children, with their parents, with their grandparents, many of our families face hardships with regard to job loss and poverty. While all Oregonians are susceptible to these hurdles, Asian and Pacific Islander communities are disproportionately affected by these realities. We face additional barriers that a basic health plan may begin to address. APANO supports HB 2934 because an Oregon basic health program has the potential to eliminate disparities within two populations currently excluded from the Oregon health plan. You heard from Alberto about the legal permanent residents who would be eligible for BHP coverage. I am going to speak about a certain group of Pacific Islanders. And this group are from the Marshall Islands, Palau, and Micronesia. They have immigrated to the United States seeking education and health services. Again, their immigration is prompted by our ongoing military interests in their home islands. We refer to this special relationship as the Compact of Free Association, or COFA. This military agreement permits these islanders to reside, work, and live in the United States legally. Oregon is home to the fifth largest COFA population in the United States. An Oregon basic health program may provide access with federal financial support for these communities who are currently ineligible for many important state services. We believe that all Oregonians should have equal access to health care, and we are not alone. APANO, along with 14 partners comprised of providers, labor representatives, and community organizations, including the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, have formed a coalition in support of HB 2934. We believe it is a measured step among the many strides taken last session to continue the conversation as to how basic health can potentially address the inequities of the Oregon health system and ultimately improve it. We thank you for your time and commitment to the health and social equity of all Oregonians. We urge you to continue to do so by voting yes on HB 2934. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, just a very quick wrap up. You've heard the discussion about basic health, but again, want to come back and underscore that the bill itself simply allows us to continue the discussion. I want to say that Oregon Health Authority has been very good to collaborate with. We work very closely with them in preparation for the study itself, and the report back to the legislature. So we expect to have a very good discussion with the Oregon Health Authority, and then reporting back to the December legislature. We'll be reporting back at the end of the calendar year.
And it's my understanding the reason that this didn't go to Ways and Means is because it's already in the health authority's work plan. They just didn't get around to it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had a very good discussion with the Oregon Health Authority. The initial bill would have cost a fair amount, bringing in an actuary to create a blueprint. And so we negotiated and backed away from that that kind of specific ask, mainly to keep the discussion going, and the very capable staff of the Oregon Health Authority will help lead that stakeholder group, and we look forward to it.
Great. Questions? Thank you very much. With that, I'll call up Doug Barber and anyone else that would like to testify.
Chair Melissa Anderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We have concerns with the basic health plan, and I fully understand the desire to find a mechanism to help ensure those two populations that were just talked about that are not eligible for subsidized insurance or Medicaid under the ACA. But the way the basic health plan is structured under the ACA, if a state like Oregon were to adopt a basic health plan, then everyone between 138 and 200% of federal poverty would have to take the basic health plan. They would have no choice. So you have currently 60,000 people in that income range who are receiving subsidized insurance from the federal government. They would have to give up that insurance and take the basic health plan. Now, for some of them, that might be great. That might be exactly what they want to do. But we know from experience that choice is very important to families. Many of you will remember when we had the FEOP program, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which was Oregon's version of subsidized insurance for low-income working families. Under that program, there was a group of, I believe they were some of the CHIP kids, who parents had a choice. They could either take Medicaid for their children for free and have a richer benefit package, or they could choose to pay subsidized premiums for their children, have a commercial insurance product, and I thought it would be a no-brainer. I thought they would take the better benefit package for free. But that's not what happened across the board. There were a number of families who said, we would prefer to pay a premium so that we could have commercial insurance. Now, maybe that's because of access. Maybe that's because they wanted their provider who was the same as the adults. I mean, there could be a whole host of reasons why. But the reality is that was the choice they made. We saw the same scenario play out last year when Cover Oregon started. Our agents reported a number of individuals who came into them and said, I just went through the Cover Oregon process. I filled out the income information. I'm eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. I don't want the Oregon Health Plan. I want subsidized commercial insurance. How can I do that? So we know that choice is important. When this issue came before the Medicaid Advisory Committee last summer, they recommended not doing a basic health plan for two reasons. One was choice, the other was access. And the access issue, they were concerned that with a plan that pays Medicaid rates, It's a challenge finding providers, particularly in some portions of the state where Medicaid's currently closed or they can't find primary care providers for people on Medicaid. This would add another 60, 70,000 people to that search for access for Medicaid providers. So I was hoping that there would be some way that we could do a waiver under the basic health plan to allow choice. I was told by legislative counsel that's not available. But there was the amendment to the Affordable Care Act that Senator Wyden introduced that allows these, they're called 1335 waivers. They begin in 2017. They give states flexibility. My hope would be that in this process that we undertake in discussions around a basic health plan, that we find some way that we can do a basic health plan with choice. If low-income working families decide that the basic health plan is in their best interest, great. But if what they want is a subsidized commercial product for whatever reason, we think they should have that choice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I, in my district, have a number of refugees and immigrants who need to have health care. You know, that is the Russian population, the Latino population. I have some Ethiopians. I have a number of homeless that are struggling to be eligible because they don't have a Social Security card or they don't have their driver's license. So, but that's another issue. I would hope that you'd be at the table.
I have been part of the discussions.
Okay,
yes. Thank you.
And hopefully, I don't know where there's a meeting of the minds, but hopefully there can be some meeting of the minds. Okay. Any other comments?
Madam Chair, yeah. If I might, I just would say my understanding is that we're up for renewal of our Medicaid waiver in 2017, and we're starting to make preparations. And one would hope, perhaps, Mr. Barber, that we could include this conversation as part of that waiver discussion. I appreciate the point that you've made. And as you know, I worked very closely with you all before to try to get families that have children in a certain income range population to have that choice. I guess I'm a little concerned that for most people in that lower income range that you referenced, that even with the subsidies, it's a question of health insurance or food, and
I understand.
Or health insurance and rent. And I appreciate also your point about the shortage of primary care providers, which is obviously a conversation that you and I have on a regular basis, and we are trying as a state to do a lot to address that issue as well. But I remain concerned about the affordability of health insurance for many Oregonians, despite the federal subsidies and the tax rebates. And I just think we need to have, just because we figure out whether it's feasible doesn't mean we have to do it if we decide that ultimately it will be detrimental to Oregonians. But we have to have the information we need to determine whether, in fact, how it plays out. And we should be considering whether we include opportunities, a discussion of this in our waiver renewal, from my perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2934 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2231.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2231A directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rule standards for determining whether information requested by a coordinated care organization from an organizational provider is redundant with respect to the reporting requirements for an assessment or if the information is outside the scope of the assessment criteria. It directs OHA to develop and maintain a centralized database for credentialing of behavioral health care organization providers and adopt rules relating to the content and operations of the database. It directs the committee to report to the Legislative Assembly no later than December 31st, 2015. There is no amendment and there is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13.
The legislature has been putting a high priority on investments in mental health. As we make those investments, we should be sure that money is spent in the most cost-effective way possible. We want to be spending the money on people who need critical mental health and chemical dependency treatment, and not on redundant administrative processes. To provide services to children and adults in more than one coordinated care organization, or CCO, treatment providers must go through multiple authorizations for each CCO, so that's multiple credentialing processes. CCOs see these unique credentialing processes as taking precautions to ensure quality care for their patients, and providers, on the other hand, see it as being badgered over and over again with the same questions. This repeated process is costly to the providers who are trying to manage the essential programs on a shoestring budget. It's using up CCO resources as well. It's taking time and money away from the main task, which is serving children that face severe behavioral and mental health treatment issues. The road to streamlining has been bumpy. Beginning in 2013 with House Bill 2020, the legislature has taken steps toward making it easier for providers to be credentialed by one CCO to provide services in other CCO areas. All sides, the CCOs and the providers and the Oregon Health Authority, understand the need for efficiency. CCOs express that they too would benefit from this, despite sincere attempts at streamlining, and they have been making attempts. We're still not completely there. There are still some roadblocks that remain to reduce the number of credentialing processes. So what this bill does is it makes it clear that redundant, unnecessary information cannot be requested of providers, and requires the Oregon Health Authority to complete work that they've already begun, to complete that work on a database of information that they gather in the credentialing process that will be useful to all the providers and the CCOs, as well as the Oregon Health Authority. The objective is to create a single source of credentialing information collected by OHA during the agency's certification process, so that CCOs should not need to ask the mental health agencies for that information. Another key element is for the health authority to work closely with the National Council for Quality Assurance, or NCQA, to ensure that they will accept and encourage this more efficient system for providers and CCOs. I want to thank everyone who's been involved in the negotiation process for this bill for the hard work in arriving at this compromise solution. Representatives from CCOs, from providers, and the Oregon Health Authority. This bill will get us another step forward, and I believe there are others in the room who can answer the more detailed or technical questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Nathanson? All right, Janet Ahrens and Doug Riggs.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a nonprofit organization representing $223 million worth of services for kids and families. That's over 100,000 children in Oregon. I want to thank Representative Nathanson. She just saved you about 4 minutes of my testimony by being so thorough and making all the most important points. Representative Nathanson really is a champion for kids, and she's also created who are the real winners of this kind of legislation. And she's also created a win-win-win situation, not only for the kids, when programs are credentialed more quickly, more efficiently, more effectively, dollars become available also more quickly and more effectively for services to be delivered to kids. Services aren't disrupted. They don't have to wait for their behavioral health treatment, and their medications are not interrupted or disrupted. And so win for the providers because of the redundancy and the many, many credentialing. If you're a larger agency and you have 10 programs and there's 18 CCOs, you can, or 16, you can do the math and figure out pretty quickly how many credentialing experiences that is. And that saves also for the CCOs. They have to conduct them. We have to respond to them. Everybody ends up spending about the same amount of time reviewing about the same amount of paper. So this is one of the few pieces of legislation I've ever had the pleasure to testify on. that creates a win-win-win for everybody, and everybody's come together in support of this solution. And we're also want to thank the Oregon Health Authority, who's really stepped up and in a big way to be able to make this happen from the technical aspect of the data bank. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I'll just simply think back a couple sessions. I think it was the 2011 or 12 session. We had one of our members, Deborah Catherine Seymour, come in from Shea-Halem Youth and Family Services in the Newburgh area. And she brought a cart with a four-foot stack from floor to about here of credentialing, licensing, and reports that they had to do in the space of 1 year. This is one small agency, and she outlined the enormous cost. But that was 1 year of credentialing and licensing for that one agency. In many cases, the different organizations that come in ask the same 29 questions, but in 29 different orders. They don't come in on a single day. They come in seven different times, and so it eats up time and resources. And I'll just echo what Janet said, which is we represent very small nonprofits that have a limited budget, and so every dollar you take out of service for kids as a result of credentialing is money that doesn't help children improve, have success, and go on to life successes. So we really appreciate the work that Representative Nathanson has done on this bill. A lot of work remains to be done with the OHA, but this is a very good step in the right direction. Thank you.
I have one question. A constituent changed from one CCO to the other. This was in a mental health organization. I assume mental health organizations is considered to be credentialed. Mm-hmm. Well, one CCO, health share, credentialed them, and another CCO did not credential this one. And so she had moved into another area and was having problems with treatment. This isn't really addressing that issue, correct? You're just going to be having a database with But I think there is an issue with some people, especially in the mental health arena, that are getting services through one CCO and then they happen to move, and the entity that they are receiving their services are not accepted by another CCO.
Chair Mona Sanderson, that is a really good example of, to Doug's point, more work to do. There are two circumstances under which we're aware of that may happen. And one is obviously the one that you described, where the second treatment provider needs to be credentialed so that the services can be paid for. The other is when we have young children who the CCO of origin, where the children are moving from to go into treatment, which is a separate CCO, then there's the original CCO who's not delivering the service or is the one who's making the determination about what the service should be. It may or may not be consistent with the services that are offered by the CCO where the treatment provider is. So we have delays there and some significant issues that we look forward to trying to resolve in the future. But this bill and this database will create the credentialing will still occur by the CCO, but it creates the repository of all the information necessary so they don't have to ask for all the materials, and they don't necessarily have to be doing a site review. So it's a savings for all. So if this provider meets those standards and submits the information to the database, it is possible for them to be certified by, credentialed by a CCO.
But it's not mandating a second CCO, correct, at this point in time?
Correct.
And I think that we, after a couple of more years, are going to be able to look at the data and see which CCOs are providing certain services, I'm hoping, in especially mental health, drug addiction treatment, that type of thing.
Chair, we would very much look forward to that data.
Yes. All right. Other questions?
I would just say this reminds me of the issue we dealt with in 2013 with credentialing providers of telemedicine. It feels like deja vu all over again. I just hope that this goes forward efficiently and that process got a little hung up, but I think we're finally getting somewhere. But it's a big issue. I mean, it's really silly that you have to do all this separate credentialing. A standard should be a standard. It's like saying, you know, well, a doctor has to be licensed differently in different counties. Well, it's bad enough I have to be licensed differently in different states. So it's good. I'm excited about this.
Okay. Any other discussion? Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2231 and open a work session on House Bill 2231.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2231A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2231A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just briefly, I just want to say that Representative Nathanson does do some very good work, so thank you on this.
Yes, she does. Mm-hmm. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Anyone want to carry this? Yes, Senator Shields would like to carry this bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2231 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3132. Is Representative Helm here?
Yes, he is.
Oh, there's Representative Helm. Have you been here a long time?
No. In the committee member?
No.
Yes.
I think this is his first session.
10 minutes. Oh, 10 minutes. Okay. All right. No, I knew that, but I didn't recognize you. Sorry about that.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for your record, my name is Ken Helm, House Representative for House District 34. And I'm introducing this bill today that I'm co-sponsoring with Representative Smith Warner. I have folks here with me today that understand the idea of conduit bonding a lot better than I do, so I'm not even going to try to explain that portion of it. But the bill is very simple in that it adds a couple of different categories of facilities that help people on both the mental health front and as a refuge from domestic violence in terms of being able to build and finance facilities that help those folks. And it adds them to a list of facilities that are already allowed and qualified for conduit financing. And I'll just tell you why I think this makes sense for counties like Washington County and Multnomah County in particular, which is where the two representatives are from that are sponsoring the bill. We still have great need for physical buildings that give people a safe place to be when they're having a mental health crisis or they're trying to escape a bad situation at home. That's subject to domestic violence. And just in my own county, in 2013, 2,200 children were forced to spend an average of 27 nights in a shelter provided by a domestic violence program. And that's, you know, obviously even one night is too many. But in that same year, nearly 12,000 requests for shelter from domestic violence went unmet. For the reasons that there's no space. And so we really need to be able to provide a more secure and available source of financing for these facilities, and that's what this bill would do. So that's my introduction to the bill without getting into the technicalities. And if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Questions for Representative Helm? Thank you so much.
Nice to have both of my representatives here in different capacities on the same day.
Thank you.
All right, Chris Vick and Mark Campbell.
You know, before I go, I'll just leave you with this. Ken Helm again for your record. Just because we're interested in numbers, this did come out of the House Healthcare Committee unanimously and from the floor with a 57 in favor vote and 3 excuse. So this has been very uncontroversial so far. So you know that.
Well, we'll see if we can change that.
Yeah, no time like the present.
You shouldn't have mentioned that. All right. Thank you so much, Representative.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mark Campbell, Chief Financial Officer for Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide some background and context as you consider House Bill 3132. Oregon statutes permit local governments to create public authorities to issue conduit bonds on behalf of nonprofit organizations that operate hospitals or that provide long-term residential care for the elderly and disabled. The Multnomah County Hospital Facilities Authority was created in December of 1998 under the statutory authority, and it provides low-cost financing for the construction of and improvements to health facilities located in the county. Since that time, the Multnomah County HFA has issued over $500 million of conduit bonds on behalf of creditworthy nonprofit organizations that operate these facilities to finance or refinance capital construction projects. The bill before the committee today, House Bill 3132, would enable the Multnomah County HFA to provide nonprofit operators of facilities that provide services to those suffering from mental illness, struggling with addiction, or fleeing domestic violence with the same access to low-cost financing available to hospitals and retirement homes. Over the past couple of years, I've been approached from time to time by nonprofit organizations seeking assistance from the Multnomah County HFA for construction projects that we've had to turn down because they did not meet the statutory requirements for the HFA's conduit bonds. Perhaps the most typical inquiry has been for the construction or renovation of a facility that provides care for people experiencing mental illness or struggling with addiction. It's always seemed to me that these facilities perform a similar function to that of hospitals and long-term care facilities for the elderly and disabled. That is, the fundamental function is to deliver professional healing and support services to residents who are struggling with acute and sometimes long-term conditions. However, under current statutes, not all credit-worthy projects that perform this basic function have equal access to the low-cost financing available from RHFA. To provide a sense of magnitude, my office examined the difference to an organization of utilizing Multnomah County Hospital Facilities Authority financing instead of a loan from a bank or other traditional financing source. As a rough rule of thumb, we determined that for every $10 million that an organization is able to borrow through the HFA instead of from a traditional source, the organization could expect to save between $75,000 and $100,000 a year for 20 years. Those savings would enable an organization providing residential mental and substance abuse care in Multnomah County to put more dollars into direct services. For example, they might be able to hire an additional two or three staff positions. Hospitals and long-term care facilities align with the county's mission to provide a functioning safety net for its residents. Similarly, the organizations proposed for inclusion in HB 3132 also align with this role, and expanding the HFA authority is a reasonable, no-cost way to further support these organizations. As a result, I respectfully urge your support for House Bill 3132, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Montes Anderson, other members of the committee. For the record, Chris Fick with Multnomah County's Office of Government Relations. Between the information that Representative Helm provided and Mr. Campbell did, I'll keep my comments short. The state obviously has a noted shortage when it comes to open beds for those suffering from mental health crises, in need of drug treatment, and in need of bed delay if they're fleeing a domestic violence situation. So we do think this is a good tool to have at the local government's disposal to help provide these important services. And the last thing I'll note is that it does have the support of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Providers as well, but they were unable to testify this afternoon. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? The bill should pass. Thank you very much. There's no one else. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3132 and open a work session on House Bill 3132.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
I'll take this one if nobody else wants it. I don't care.
Okay. Senator Steiner Hayward has volunteered to carry it, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3132, and we're adjourned.